You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome back to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by our producer, Troy Ifaiakine, coming up on the show. I spoke to Associate Professor of Māori and Pacific Studies, Jemima Tiatia, and the Associate Dean Pacific of the Faculty of Health and Medical Sciences, Sir Colin Tuku-i-Tonga, about Kamal Sepuloni becoming Aotearoa's first Pacifica Deputy Prime Minister, Tertiary Education Union organiser Jill Jones about the union's legal action against redundancies at the Auckland University of Technology, and academic GP at the University of Auckland, Nikki Turner, about Jacinda Ardern's legacy on child poverty. Troy, who will you be speaking with today?
Today I spoke with Head of Campaigns for Safe, Jess Chambers, about why battery-caged eggs were banned.
Hea ha whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today, so get in touch. Tuku patuhi mai, text us on 5395 or wire mai rane, and give us a call as well in the studio on 309 3879. Ka ua I wariwari, e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anō hi pakihiri roki roki maurunga, I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōho. Mi haere ki 95 BFM ira kati.com. Catch all these stories we're about to play for you and more by podcast on the 95 BFM website, 95bfm.com.
I'm Paddy Garin. This is the fucking news on The Wire.
Kamal Sepuloni has just been appointed as Aotearoa's first ever Pacifica Deputy Prime Minister. I spoke to Associate Professor of Māori and Pacific Studies, Jemima Tiatia, and the Associate Dean Pacific at the Faculty of Health and Medical Sciences, Sir Colin Tuku-i-Tonga, who are both from the University of Auckland, about what this historic appointment means for our Pacific communities in Aotearoa and our country. First, here is Jemima Tiatia.
I think for Pacific communities, it's significant in that aspiring young Pacific women can see themselves in some of those governance areas. And politics isn't exactly the vocation for all, but you know, to see that it is possible, I think that's a huge positive. And for the country, I mean, it speaks for all women, even though, you know, the former PM, Jacinda, had stepped down for probably many, many reasons, but one of those that's highlighted in the media is around the betrayal and the misogyny that she had received in her terms. To have Kamal appointed and for her to take up that mantle in light of all that speaks volumes, and it also speaks to her grunt and her resilience as a leader. So, I mean, it has huge benefits. And I know she's not, the Labour Party isn't the most popular at the moment, but with both of them at the helm, I think there's some real drive and strong leadership.
Based on your understanding, can you tell us a bit about Kamal Sepuloni's political career so far and what some of her key achievements have been?
I'm not too well versed in her policies, but she's been around for a while, I think between 4 to 5 terms. So you know, she's a stalwart and she's solid. And I think too, she comes from a place that the average New Zealander may be able to relate to. We also saw some of the drama around the benefit fraud of a loved one. And I don't mean to bring that up again to destroy her reputation anyway, but to speak to it, to give volume to it, and that she understands what the average New Zealander may be going through. And she's been in and around the Pacific circles for a long time. So I'm happy she's there because she is, like I said, very resilient. She's a tough cookie. And it means it's such an amazing appointment for, and a celebration for Pacific communities and Pacific women or women of colour in general.
And there's been a bit of criticism against Labor for passing over a Pacifica or a Maori member for the top job of Prime Minister. What do you think has contributed to there not being a Prime Minister or before Carmel Cipollone, a Deputy Prime Minister of either Maori or Pacifica descent before?
That's a huge question and probably one that I'd open myself up to for criticism myself. But, it's systemic. There are larger issues at play. We all know what those issues are. That political game is still being played out, and it has been for centuries, you know. And so without saying too much, there's still a lot of work to be done, especially with our minorities, with our tangata whenua. You know, is New Zealand bold enough to make those appointments, to have our very first person of colour as the Prime Minister of this country? I'm not too sure. Hopefully in my lifetime, we're seeing the growth in the political parties themselves with that diversity. So I don't see it too far away, but it is something that a lot of people are calling for.
With her background as the Minister of Social Development and also being our first Pacific Deputy Prime Minister, do you have any ideas about what sort of influence she may have on policy for the future of the Labour Party?
I think her deep insight into that aspect, or I guess the population that it impacts the most in terms of social issues and economic issues. Like I said, she's on the ground. She's lived it herself. She's come from an upbringing as the average New Zealander has. And although there has been some criticism about her not doing enough while she was in that role, I seem to see it, I guess, flourish in other areas, particularly in education and all the spaces I've been in. She's there. She's huge support. I couldn't tell you. It'll be interesting to see what will happen in the reshuffle on Friday when they announce that. I'm looking forward to that and probably give a probably well-informed response, I suspect.
Then I spoke to Sir Colin Tuku'i Tonga about why he believes Cipollone's appointment is a positive sign for Pacific health.
Well, firstly, I think it's tremendous for Carmel and her whānau. I think it's great for New Zealand that we are seeing more diversity in our political leaders. I am personally hopeful that Carmel Cipollone as Deputy Prime Minister might advance, accelerate, make some courageous decisions with regard to some of the chronic health inequities that we see in New Zealand, particularly for Māori and Pacifica people. I mean, obviously, there's a Minister of Health and others, but Deputy Prime Minister, I would imagine, would have some sway, some influence in decisions, investment decisions by the government in the health area.
Why is it so important for there to be Pacific leaders when it comes to addressing Pacific health issues?
Well, I think it makes a difference that people in the decision-making roles are of Pacific heritage and origin. They will have the cultural awareness and knowledge, sensitivities about what motivates Pacific communities to do something or not do something. They have extensive knowledge and networks in those communities. So they have that extra edge in terms of knowledge and awareness of the challenges, I guess, and how people think about health problems and how they might react. So it does offer, I think, some additional benefit. I mean, obviously, there are some core health challenges for everyone, but I think given our inability, I think, to address these inequities, I'm hopeful Carmel will have more influence in assisting this process going forward. I think it's important because the Pacific Associate Minister of Health responsible for Pacific Health Outcomes, Peter Williams-Yaw, is stepping back this year as well. So I just think it's really important that there's some continuity.
There are many inequities in our public health system, particularly for Māori and Pacifica. What are some improvements that you're hoping to see in our health system in the next few years?
Well, I'm particularly concerned about tamariki, you know, our children and young people, Ngātahi and tamariki. So if you look at rheumatic fever, for example, as a particular problem in Māori and Pacifica children and young people, and I think we should address the conditions that lead to acute rheumatic fever and rheumatic heart disease, because it is a totally preventable disease. So I'm focusing on children and young people. I think there's increasing concern about mental health of young people, particularly rangatahi, and that we as a country respond effectively. In the adult base, the biggie, of course, is always diabetes and heart disease, and diabetes leads to kidney dialysis and all of those horrible outcomes. So I'm hopeful that we start to address the common and most pressing problems like diabetes.
What would your advice for the government, or I suppose heading into election year, for any incoming government to go about addressing some of these inequities?
The Māori Health Authority is resourced and supported, because I do think, you know, we've been through a series of health reforms in the past. They don't always deliver what we hope, but I do think the Māori Health Authority is an innovation that, if it's resourced and supported, it could affect real change for Māori in particular. So I'm hopeful that those kinds of interventions are supported. And in the Pacific space, there is a health plan that's been promulgated. I hope the plan is resourced and implemented, because, you know, we've written and have had several plans in the past that haven't really achieved what we had hoped. So I'm hopeful that we continue to invest to support interventions for improving Pacifica health in Aotearoa.
To the best of your knowledge, how has Carmel Cipollone been involved with Pacific Health or Pacific communities throughout her time in Parliament?
Well, pre-Parliament, Carmel was involved. I think she was the CEO of a health research organisation. She was involved in social development activities. She has extensive networks in the community. She's extremely well known in her electorate in Kelston area, and of course amongst the professional networks of Pacifica people. She has an education background, so she's got both health and education experience pre-Parliament. And since being in Parliament, of course, she's had a difficult role in the social development portfolio, and I imagine she would have learned a few things in that portfolio. I certainly think Carmel has the knowledge and background to address the issues, perhaps with the added strength, I guess, or kudos of being the Deputy Prime Minister. I just think it's tremendous, as I say, for Carmel and her family. But I also think it's great for the Pacifica community. Naturally, it'll raise expectations, and I hope people are realistic about that. And it's good for us, for our country, that Carmel will partner up with Chris Hipkins and keep the momentum going of the achievements that we have had in recent years, particularly in Pacific health, education and housing.
That was the University of Auckland's Jemima Tiatia, followed by Sir Colin Tukuitonga, with their thoughts on Aotearoa's new Deputy Prime Minister, Carmel Cipollone. We'll be back right after this short break. Keep it on the B.
What's a seven-letter word for Street Fighter?
No idea. I know that tonight at Ponsonby Social Club there's
Botico Beats with Juliana Sion and guests, with support from Bobby Brazuka.
And tomorrow,
DJs Carlotta, Maioha and Momo.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
Doof, 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 ding.
Bike Rave is back and coming to the Ōrākei Basin, featuring the one and only Dan Ox.
The most fun you can have on two wheels. Bike Rave takes you on a group ride ending at Ōrākei Basin, where you'll park up for a silent party at the water's edge.
Made possible by Auckland Transport, Bike Auckland, Club Mate and Interesting Things.
Bike Rave Ōrākei with Dan Ox, Saturday, February 4th. Tickets are free but extremely limited. Reserve yours now at Eventbrite.
Performing in New Zealand for the first time in 5 years, Lord. Live at the Outer Fields at Western Springs, March 4th. The long-awaited tour. From Pure Heroine,
to melodrama to solar power.
Then we're fine with this. We didn't come for money.
Don't miss Lord with special guests Marlon Williams, Phaser Days, and Ricky Reed. March 4th at the Outer Fields at Western Springs. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old collector guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jubden Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your bass lines lying around here.
Sitting at the bus stop on West Coast, rolling my headphones, banging in the red zone. Stone trying to get home next to some lesbo, dressed in a trench coat, Nana in a bedrobe. Fresh out the rest home, this feels like it's death row. Plus the bus running, they supposed to come at 8 and now it's 9. And I don't want to wait around with these weirdos, dressed like scarecrows, Metallica shirts, linen plates in the earlobes. So I start walking just to kill the boredom, past the Harvey Norman, then the sneaker store. And that was when I saw him, 87 weapons. Fresh from the heavens, undefeated size 11s. You got 10s, he said he'll get him from the back. While he's gone, I just watch him shine on the rack. Fighting with my mind, one guy gets like, you want this crap? The other guy gets like, what's wrong with that? See, I can tell you some shit, but I ain't gonna act like nobody's slave for this letterman that's on my back. And I ain't calming, this is more subconscious rap. I'm just trying to make an honest track. But it's hard to be a man and a sneaker fan, holding kicks made in Vietnam, playing Georgia and singing about freedom and veganism while I eat a hamburger. Should I turn her off and listen to some Steely Dan? Cause man, I love the custard creams and the mustard greens. Plus I got a hundy, I could blow it on a couple tees. Sick of wearing crusty jeans with busted seams. So fuck my dreams, bro, how much are these? He said 100, that's when I said I wonder what it was that I wanted, the kicks or just the confidence. And then something clicked, then I left. And my fucked up New Balance took another step on the pathway. Wait, just trying to live it like my last day. No time to worry what the stars say. Nah, just trying to give it my all, cause all I'm giving is life. It's what I'm living like my last day. Just gotta listen what my heart say. It's time for stress and what you can't change. Nah, just trying to give it my all, cause all I'm giving is life. It's what I'm living like my last day. Sitting on a slow boat to Thailand, staring out the right hand side, paradises far as the eye can see, feeling like man, it's just a giant ant crawling on a flagging rock, carrying some eye candy. So why am I so caught up in what I have, I want, I need, iPad, my bad. I must have forgot how hard life can be for people. They here dying for some rice and peace. They live off the earth, digging the dirt we see. It's in the world, villages turn into rice that Western is burned with no concern. And it's like that, later it's learned in the reserve, then it's right back to life. Roll up the herbs, smoke up the world like empathy is only a word. I think our heads got big as the bird. We say they live in the fur. Who are we to say that this is the first? Only cause we ain't got a second to give to a beckon. Man or a hand to lend, and I'ma beginners say they lower class. The student teachers for your yoga class. What's life going off? The fisherman is floating past my window. Show me your mansion with more manners than this temple. Drunk off the beer, essentials. Can it be that it was all so simple? Before the east side moved central, we praise the elegant high flyers and billionaires. They praise the elephants, white tigers, and grizzly bears. Smiling through the worst flood they had in 50 years. Cause they see everything comes, then it disappears. They got no hipsters here. Nobody bitching about the shit they wear. Nobody consumed by consumerism here. And they ain't got no prisons here. Because the system's fair. They're just existing here. Living this as if it's their last day.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395.
In late last year, AUT announced 230 redundancies, among a number of other cost-cutting measures, despite making a $12 million surplus in 2020 and 2021. The Employment Court has now ruled in favour of the Tertiary Education Union in their legal action against AUT. AUT has been fined for breaching their collective agreement with staff and will have to restart their redundancy process. So what does this mean now for affected staff? I asked TEU organiser Jill Jones. We started off our interview discussing why the TEU pursued legal action against AUT.
Back in September, AUT announced that because of COVID and declining student enrollment, it wanted to make 150 academic staff members redundant. That's a huge amount, obviously. A few weeks later, it then upped that number to 170. TU didn't accept that the redundancies at AUT were necessary or justified, and right from the very beginning, back in September, we told them that the redundancies would harm their staff, would harm students, and would harm AUT's reputation. And we told our members that we would fight for their jobs, which we have done. AUT continued anyway. There were several problems with what AUT proposed, not least of which was the unnecessary response to a hopefully short-term financial problem. Then there was the problem of not getting enough information and not fronting up to allow staff to ask questions. But the biggest problem was they were trying to make people rather than positions redundant. And in carrying out the redundancies, AUT didn't abide by the collective agreement. So there's a process that had to be followed, and AUT didn't follow it. TU then took the matter to the Employment Relations Authority, which ordered AUT to comply with the collective agreement, but AUT didn't. So we then went to the Employment Court, which was very recently, which also said that AUT hadn't abided the compliance order. The Employment Court fined AUT for failing to comply with the compliance order, and that was a significant warning, not just to AUT, but to other employers that you know you have to respect collective agreements. When they prescribe a process, that process must be followed. So that's the basic background. What's happened to the decision of the Employment Court.
What was the outcome of this legal action?
So you see, the court said that you're going to have to go back and follow the collective agreement, and you're going to have to withdraw the notice of dismissal that you've given to the AUT academics. So AUT had given notice of dismissal to academic staff. And hey, many of those are internationally respected scholars and some have made a huge contribution to New Zealand society. But those termination notices were due to take effect from the 1st of February. Those notices were now invalid. The court said that AUT has to go back, follow the collective agreement. It must identify positions, not people, who are potentially surplus. Then it must invite those people to apply for voluntary redundancy. And it's only then that they can issue termination notices. The termination notices contain 2 months' notice. So that's where we're at the moment. So no one's actually dismissed right now. because the termination notices had to be withdrawn.
And what compensation would you like to see for these staff members who,
Well, look, I mean, they haven't left yet, and we would like AUT to withdraw these redundancies in their entirety because we don't believe that they were necessary in the first place. So that would be the actual best case scenario for our members because, you know, there's been a huge human cost in all of this, but we want to... We want AUT to acknowledge what they've done wrong and apologise for the harm that they've caused to students and to staff. But the most important thing is we want them to withdraw this because we don't believe that the redundancies are necessary in the first place.
You mentioned that AUT or the courts determined that AUT should identify positions and not people in their redundancy plan. There's been a bit of discussion about certain staff members saying that they felt like they had been targeted. Can you tell me a little bit about this?
So what they've done is they've gone through the staff and they've decided who hasn't done enough research or the type of research that they want and who hasn't done enough undergraduate teaching. And on the basis of that list, they've said that those people are redundant. Of course, that's completely unfair. Because a lot of those people, for instance, just to use one example, had been very heavily involved in postgraduate teaching. They didn't count that. And so if you hadn't got enough undergraduate teaching, really, you basically often lost your job through no fault of your own. And also the research was a real problem because they counted... the COVID period as well, where, of course, a lot of people weren't able to do enough research. So that was grossly unfair and would, for many of them, sound a personal grievance, you know, for unfair treatment. But right, I don't want to get ahead to that yet because we're hoping, they've asked to meet with us, and we're hoping that they'll just withdraw the thing.
The impact on staff is quite clear, but can you tell me a bit about what the impact on students at AUT has been?
Oh, yeah, no, the impact on students has been huge. It's not a good situation for students. We've already seen the effect on postgraduate students because many lost their primary supervisor. Students have made it clear how they felt about that. I mean, there's the severing of the relationship, which can be devastating. And that's especially so when you're close to completion of, say, a PhD. So there was a petition signed by about 850 students, but some students have also talked in the media about losing their supervisors and what that will mean for them. But you know, I mean, talking about students and staff go hand in hand, that was devastating for staff as well, because you can imagine what it's like if you've been with a student up to a certain point in their dissertation, and then you as a supervisor have to leave. It's heartbreaking for the staff and it's heartbreaking for the students. But, you know, one thing that's really remarkable about AUT staff is their dedication to the students. So some of them were willing to work for lower pay just to see their students through. But it wasn't just postgraduate students that were affected. A lot of students have been concerned about whether their chosen courses will be offered at all this year, because AUT has lost so many staff already, whether it's through voluntary redundancy or they've just left. Some programs we know have been cancelled. Hey, just recently I was reading about a student who said she felt like the rug had been pulled out from under her after her course for next year was cancelled at a week's notice. So that was the cancellation of the Master of English and New Media Studies, I think. She had to scramble about for a new place to study in this year. And that was in late December. But she said, according to the media article, that she got a sense of betrayal and also panic. She said she was offered no advice or support. So by the time she was notified that the course would be closed, applications were closed at the University of Auckland. And I really hope that she doesn't miss out on her studies for this year. AUT really shouldn't put people in that sort of position. It's not fair. It looks now as if it's there's going to be short staffing in some areas and that they're going to try to make that up by using casualised hourly paid staff and teaching assistants, which, as you know, is very far from ideal. I found out this morning that they were advertising in social sciences and public policy for this. So it's insecure wood, which is good for neither the staff nor the students.
What message do you think this recent outcome and also the damage to universities' reputation has sent to universities across the country?
I think it sends a message. Well, first of all, I do believe that there has been great damage to the university's reputation, but I also think that it sends a message to all employers, and not just university employers, that collective agreements have to be respected. You can't reach a collective agreement with impunity. You know, staff are very angry about the way they've been treated by AET. But it does seem that message that, yes, you need to do these things properly, because after all, it's people's lives that you're dealing with, you know. But I have to tell you, our members see it as a victory, not only for the union, but also for the collective agreement. They now won't be dismissed on the 1st of February, and it gives them some breathing space. But, you know, we postgraduate students are close to completion. Hopefully the supervisor will still be around for a while, but there's no guarantee of that. And I think our members have got a kind of a sense that justice has been done to some degree, because the legal system hasn't let AET get away with breaching the collective agreement. And like I said, that's a really important message for all employers. You can't get away with breaching the collective agreement. So our members are pleased about that. But nothing really, I guess, compensates for the anxiety and the disappointment and the hurt and the stress that AET's put them through. You know, they're really pleased that the judgment sends a message that you can't breach a collective agreement with impunity, but they understandably are still angry. You know, I mean, these are people who've been loyal to AUT for more than 20 years. And a lot of them are leaders in their field, both nationally and internationally, and held in very high esteem by both undergraduate and postgraduate students. And there's a human cost that you can't pay by just offering people a couple of counselling sessions. And all of this distress could have been avoided if AUT, or a large amount of this distress, could have been avoided if AUT had just followed the collective agreement in the first place.
And just lastly, can you give us any insight into the TEU's plans heading into this year for addressing staff's concerns at universities across Aotearoa?
Yes, well, we will be meeting with our members on Wednesday. Today's Wednesday, on Friday. And the message that we'll be giving to them is carry on per normal, right? Obviously, they already feel that they've been vindicated to some extent. But the message I'll give to people is join your union, because we will fight for you. We've fought for these members of AUT, and we will go on fighting for them, because AUT now wants to meet with us, and they say they want to discuss a way forward. We've written to the Vice-Chancellor, and we said, yeah, we can meet with you, but in our view, the plan dismissals are neither necessary nor appropriate. If they want to continue down the path they've chosen, we'll challenge the criteria on which they want to select people for redundancy. So we will go on fighting for our members' jobs. So my message to people working in tertiary institutions, whether they're lecturers or allied staff, is to join your union. It's important. We will fight.
That was Tertiary Education Union organiser Jill Jones on the outcome of their legal action against AUT. And yesterday was the final day of Jacinda Ardern's time as Prime Minister, as she formally hands the role over to incoming leader Chris Hipkins, aka Chippy. Today on The Wire, we will be looking back on Ardern's legacy on child poverty. I spoke to academic GP at the University of Auckland and director of the Immunisation Advisory Centre, Professor Nikki Turner, who says that Ardern has done more than any Prime Minister before, but that there is still a long way to go towards ending child poverty in Aotearoa. Here is Turner now. Ending child poverty was a platform that Jacinda Ardern committed to very strongly. How successful do you believe her government has been in reducing child poverty?
It's a mixed bag. I have to say she's made more strides than probably any other politician, and we absolutely celebrate that. What she has done, unlike any previous administration before her, is firstly put child poverty on the agenda and secondly bring in the Child Poverty Reduction Act in 2018. Now, the importance of that is it's now a political requirement to report on progress or lack of progress. So that's a major step forward, that child poverty is on the agenda. It has to be reported on. Governments have to discuss it, and we need to look at strategies going forward. So that's really, really important step. Has it made a difference? Yes, it has. It's made a small amount of progress, but significant progress. Overall, we do have less children in poverty, less children in severe hardship, but we've still got a very, very long way to go, and a lot of our kids are still suffering badly.
Aotearoa made a commitment to halve child poverty by 2030. Do you, first of all, believe that this is a good enough goal for us to aim to? Is it enough? And also, are we on track to even achieving that?
So reversing your question, we're not on track. We have seen some significant reduction, but we're not on track. And more than that, the equity gaps are huge. So particularly children from backgrounds of disability, Māori children, Pacifica, are suffering the most. We've got a very long way to go. We're not on track, but we have seen reductions. Halving is great, but to be honest, as a country, if we want our kids to grow up emotionally, physically, educationally mature with great outcomes for our country, then we aim for more and more and more. So this needs to be a full country commitment. We are not putting enough effort in as a country, across the political board, across our community. It's hard for everybody out there, really hard. But people need to realise that allowing children to be born and grow up in their early years in poverty matters and will have major consequences for our community long term. It should remain unacceptable to all of us.
Labor has promised a review of working for families. Is this something you'd like to see? And what issues do you see here?
Yes, absolutely. There needs to be a review of working for families. A lot of our policy drivers are clumsy. They're not always working effectively. The concept of raising children out of poverty, certainly families, when they can, need to be able to work, but we also have to help families who are not always able to enter the workforce. So even calling it working for families is inappropriate for children. Many benefits are lost because of some of the inappropriate clawbacks, the way the system's designed. There's a whole lot of gaps in the system. There's a review that's been done previously, but still there's a lot of issues outstanding that have not been addressed.
Are there any further steps other than this that you would like to see the incoming Prime Minister Chris Hipkins and his government take to build on the work that's already been done?
Yeah, well, the Welfare Working Family Review has been done and was very thorough. There was a huge amount of recommendations out of that. Only a few of them have been taken up. Even starting from that and moving with that is important. Looking at tax reform, looking at the things that really ease the burden on those in most significant poverty is the most important step right now. So starting and recognising the damage and the effect in most significant poverty for what it does to children and their outcome is the starting point. So this review's been done. There's really good recommendations out there now. Let's look at those and start from those and not just cherry pick the easy ones.
Going into election year, what would you say that any incoming government could learn from Ardern's legacy on child poverty?
I think the putting in place the Child Poverty Reduction Act must stay there. It has to be across government. It has to be a unified approach. It should not be a political football. We should not have parties arguing about how to do it. A welfare reform is urgent and needs to happen. We need to look at the reviews that have already been done and pick up the recommendations now. A lot more can be done, and it needs to be with cross-party support. It needs to get away from a political football. It needs to be a unified country response. For more information and more details around these broader comments, go to the Child Poverty Action Group website and have a look at that.
That was Professor Nikki Turner from the University of Auckland on Jacinda Ardern's legacy on child poverty. We'll be back right after a short break. Keep it on the beat.
The New Zealand history of beer, the 19th century.
Wake up, you salty old coot! The redcoats are here to rip down your illegal grog shop! Come on!
Bugger off, you bastards! I recognise no authority but the Mad King of Beer, and hereby claim my sovereign rights to this very spot. This beer spot, if you will.
Your grog's giving everyone the shits. Come on!
The 20th century.
Right, that's 6 p.m. Out of the wool shed, you salty old coots! This beer spot's shut till 5:30 p.m. tomorrow.
The 21st century.
And so apparently there's been beers on this very spot for 200 years.
Oh, is that?
Can I help you with our selection of craft beers, folks?
We'll have a round of salty old coots, please.
One thing is better these days, and that's the quality of beers. Grab your mates and hit the beer spot. With 40 delicious beersies on tap and 5 locations Auckland wide, the beer spot is your tappy place. For opening hours and to find out more, head to thebeerspot.co.nz.
Bust out the sprinkler and set your lawnmower to stun. Gardens Music Festival is the brand new inner city garden boogie, taking your summer by storm at the stunning new venue of Auckland Domain. Featuring a headline performance from living legend Fatboy Slim, plus LPGOB, Sedmo, Peking Duck, John Morales, and more. Gardens Music Festival, Sunday, January 29th at Auckland Domain. Get your tickets now from gardensmusicfestival.co.nz.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
Relationships that go through, and I give it all away just so I could say that. But I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. You know there's no rhyme or reason for the way you turned out to be. I didn't go and try to change my mind not intentionally. I know it's hard to hear me say it, but I can't bear to stay. And I just know that you're gonna be okay anyway. Always keep your heart locked tight. Don't let your mind rebel. Oh, but I just couldn't take it. I tried out and I to beg it, but I fumbled. And when it came down through the wire, it felt bad. It felt right. But I fumbled. And when it came down through the wire, it felt bad. It felt right. But I fumbled. And when it came down through the wire, it's your imagination trying to make you what you want it to be. Because I'm sorry I do what I did, but it came naturally. And I give it up away just so I could say that. Well, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. When I try to keep myself together after all the opportunities, I try to stay true to you and I try to do what you wanted from me. And I give it up away just to hear you say that. Well, I know that you're gonna be okay anyway. Always keep your heart locked tight. Don't let your mind rebel. Oh, but I just couldn't take it. I tried out and I to beg it, but I fumbled. And when it came down to the wire, it felt bad. It felt right. Oh, but I fumbled. And when it came down to the wire, it felt bad. It felt right. Oh, but I fumbled. And when it came down to the wire, yeah.
naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Welcome back to The Wire. Across the country, eggs have been lacking, and the price of the few cartons available has gone up by 16% since November 2022. But the reason for our egg shortage marks a positive change in the welfare expectations of captive bred animals. The phased ban on battery cages came to its final stage as we entered 2023, meaning these cages are now 100% illegal to use in New Zealand. Today, I spoke with the head of campaigns for the animal welfare organisation SAFE, Jess Chambers, about what this new ban of battery cages means for egg farming and what could come in the future of the egg industry. New Zealanders have been up in arms about the current egg shortage, but I understand the banning of battery cages does mark an important change in the welfare expectations of caged hens. For our listeners who might not know the reality of the lives caged hens live, can you explain why New Zealand has actually banned battery cages?
Yeah, so battery cages are very small little metal cages. They give hens inside of them space less than the size of an A4 sheet of paper to live on. All a hen in a battery cage can do is eat, drink, and lay eggs, and that's it. There's no room to move around. There's no place to rest comfortably. They can't exhibit any normal behaviours that a hen would naturally do. So New Zealand has what's called the Animal Welfare Act, and this act states that all animals must be allowed the ability to express normal patterns of behaviour, and obviously hens crammed into a battery cage or a colony cage can't express natural behaviours. And this is why they were banned. So it was 10 years in the making. The industry had 10 years to phase out battery cages because they breached the law. And that's what had happened on January the 1st. All battery cages were gone for good in New Zealand.
That sounds really interesting. So now that battery cages are banned, there have been reports that say the alternative to battery cages are colony cages. Is this a viable option for safe egg farming, or are we looking at an option that isn't much better?
Colony cages, they aren't any better than a battery cage. A hen in a colony cage has space the size of an A4 sheet of paper to themselves, whereas battery was a little bit less than a sheet of paper. So you have larger cages with even more birds shoved inside of them. Colony cages breach the same law as battery cages, and that's, you know, not allowing them the ability to express normal patterns of behaviour. And around the world, these cages are being banned and gotten rid of for the same reason. But here in New Zealand, they are still allowed despite the clear issues.
So moving forward, what in SAFE's eyes is the next step to ensuring the safety of New Zealand's working hens?
So we would like to see a ban on all caged farming systems in New Zealand. You know, the lack of action from the New Zealand government banning all cages is causing millions of animals to languish in conditions our laws are supposed to protect them from. So that's the first step. We would like to see all cages gone for good in New Zealand.
Beyond the next step, what do you think could be done to make the egg industry more ethical in the future?
The words egg industry and ethical, they don't go together. There are a few reasons why. From the get-go, male chicks, they can't grow up to lay eggs, so they're considered to be waste products. So within a day of hatching, male chicks are killed in a pretty horrific way. They're minced alive, essentially. Another reason why egg farming isn't ethical is because it's routine practice to kill hens when they're about 18 months of age, and this is because they can't lay enough eggs to be as profitable as a younger hen. These animals are being pushed to their physical limits. They're used up and then they're thrown away. So no matter the farming system, cage, barn, free range, commercially farmed hens are and will always be treated like egg-laying machines. And so that's why when people ask, you know, what is the best option then? The best option is to try the cruelty-free egg replacements out there. They're affordable, they taste good, and they don't contribute to the exploitation of hens.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa, I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnā rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, Associate Professor of Māori and Pacific Studies, Jemima Tiatia, Associate Dean Pacific of the Faculty of Health and Medical Sciences, Sir Colin Tuku'i Tonga, Tertiary Education Union Organiser Jill Jones, Academic GP at the University of Auckland, Nikki Turner. And Troy, do you want to thank your guest as well?
Thank you, Jess Chambers, speaking about battery cages and the ethics of egg farming.
Great. Nē rā hoki ki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Bridge. See you next time.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.